My name is Michael Welch, and you are listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Innu, the Oji-Cree, the Dene, and the Dakota, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Listeners of this program are familiar with the many instances of the U.S. hypocritically undermining democracies abroad to serve the country's own resource and military needs. Iran in 1953, Guatemala in 1954, Chile in 1973, and Haiti in 2003 are just a few examples of this phenomenon. However, what is not particularly well known is how Canada, America's supposedly more temperate brother in the North, has also directly had a hand in ousting democracies throughout the world. A new book, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, is the first book detailing over 20 democratic governments since 1950 that Canada has had a hand in overthrowing. Canada would cut off aid and impose sanctions on the target government while financing the opposition, and even allow protesters to use the Canadian embassy as a staging point for toppling a president. It would organize a secret meeting, committing to the overthrow of a popular leader and picking a replacement, while using its military to subvert governments. It was a recent book by author Yves Engler and his co-author Owen Schalk. On June 20th of this year, the two were presenting at the University of Winnipeg in front of dozens of spectators. Owen Schalk was present in person. Yves joined us by Zoom. I had the great distinction of introducing them myself, so we bring this talk to you now, here on the Global Research News Hour in the summer. I would like to welcome Owen Schalk to the stage. This is the co-author, and he was able to make it, as he lives in Manitoba, in rural Manitoba, and in addition to co-authoring Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, he's a columnist for Canadian Dimension magazine and the author of Canada in Afghanistan, and, you know, a story of military, diplomatic, political, and media failure, 2003 to 2023. A well-researched and well-sourced, well-written and accessible book. So Owen is sharp and influential and industrious, and may be back to be restored as his writing continues to flourish in the years to come. So Owen is currently working on his third book, which is entitled Canada's Role in 2011, NATO's War on Libya. So right now he will focus on Canada's long fight against democracy. So will you please, Owen, have a seat and show us what you've got.
I want to begin my remarks on this book in a somewhat indirect way, not by talking about the book itself, but by describing a recent delegation I joined that demonstrated to me very clearly the main argument of our book, which is that Canadian foreign policy does not promote democracy around the world, and that, in fact, in many cases, Canada undermines democracy globally. So last month, I visited Guatemala with a delegation organized by the group Rights Action. And this was a delegation specifically to learn about atrocities committed by the Guatemalan government, historical and ongoing. And it was also a delegation to learn about the insidious role that Canadian mining companies occupy in Guatemala today, and how they are directly connected to the atrocities of the Guatemalan state, historic and present, and how they actually benefit from these atrocities. So some background. In 1944, the U.S.-backed dictator of Guatemala, Jorge Ubico, was removed in a popular pro-democracy uprising. And for the next 10 years, the country was governed by progressive presidents, first Juan José Arévalo and then Jacobo Arbenz. And one of the pillars of their program was land reform and land redistribution to benefit the peasantry. The U.S. government, of course, opposed these reforms, as they would hurt the profits of U.S. fruit companies. So Eisenhower and the CIA launched Operation PB Success to remove the elected president Arbenz from power. And as we outline in the book, Canada was supportive of the coup against Arbenz, and after the Guatemalan military came to power with U.S. backing, Canadian investment followed, especially in mining. The Canadian government helped isolate Arbenz in the lead up to the coup, with the U.S. seeking to destabilize his government and to prevent his government from redistributing these unproductive lands owned by U.S. companies. Arbenz wanted to demonstrate to Washington that his government in Guatemala had good relations with Ottawa, a U.S. ally, and thus that he was not a threat to U.S. interests. Arbenz sent a request to the Canadian government asking that they open embassies in each other's countries, again, to show the U.S. that his government was not a threat to them. But Ottawa refused his request twice, first in 1953 and then again in 54. In the book Northern Shadows, the journalist Peter McFarlane summarizes Canada's response to Arbenz's overthrow. This is a quote. At External Affairs Canada and in Canadian corporate boardrooms, the coup against Arbenz was chalked up as another victory of the free world against the Soviet menace. But while Canadian diplomats and businessmen celebrated the coup against Arbenz, to Guatemalans themselves, it represented the total destruction of their fledgling democracy. Arbenz's successor, Castillo Armas, immediately outlawed peasant organizations and unions and reversed the previous 10 years of agrarian reform. And this coup led to military dictatorship, genocide, hundreds of thousands of deaths, and a national trauma that remains imprinted on Guatemala to this day. And I saw it there. Like, for instance, in Guatemala City, there's photos of the disappeared along the walls of buildings. There's posters that proclaim, yes, there was a genocide here. And there are tributes on the street to people like Bishop Herardi and Myrna Mack, who were murdered for challenging what Guatemalans call the Pacto de Corruptos, or the traditional political and economic elite. And I want to emphasize that after the overthrow of Arbenz in 54, this Canadian-backed coup, the military government set Guatemala on fire. Progressives in the cities were kidnapped, tortured, and disappeared. 626 rural communities, primarily Maya, were annihilated in the 70s and 80s. By the time of the signing of the peace accords in 96, around 200,000 Guatemalans were dead and 40,000 disappeared by the state. 83% of the victims were indigenous Maya. 93% of the human rights violations were committed by Guatemalan state forces with the backing of Washington and Ottawa. And as I said, this was a campaign of violence that amounted to genocide. So in this period, the strategic elimination of socialists and communists, progressives, trade unionists, cooperatives, and the raising of entire villages to make room for extraction and megaproject development, all of this laid the foundation for what Graham Russell and Catherine Nolan call the transnational plunder that followed, plunder from which Canada still benefits to this day. Since 96, Canadian mining investment has poured into Guatemala. Canada-based mining companies are so prevalent in the country, and their social, economic, and environmental impact is so devastating, that some analysts refer to this influx of Canadian investment as a fourth conquest against the indigenous peoples. The first being the Spanish conquest, the second being the creation of a brutal plantation economy, and the third being the genocidal repression that followed the Canadian-backed coup against Arbenz in 54. While I was in Guatemala, I visited several struggles against Canadian mining: La Puya, an hour north of Guatemala City, the Maya Kekchi resistance in El Estor, the struggle against the Cerro Blanco mine in Asuncion Mita, and the Xinka-led resistance to the El Escobal mine. And while each struggle has its own origin and contexts, I noticed several common denominators, perhaps the most striking being this: Canada does not care one whit about democracy. Ottawa has claimed that by cooperating with the Guatemalan government, including through the Lima Group, that now defunct organization to overthrow Venezuela's government, that they are supporting democracy and human rights in the region. But I spoke to activists and survivors throughout the country, through Guatemala, that is, family members of the disappeared, people who are involved in these struggles, and they constantly spoke about the crimes of the Pacto de Corruptos, this elite that has ruled the country since the coup. And these Guatemalans have no illusions about democracy in their country. They know that it's a lie. Canada also claims to support development in Guatemala, including by promoting Canadian mining investment. But I visited with locals who live around Canadian-owned projects, and I heard their experiences of state repression, ecological degradation, terrifying run-ins with mining security. These people know that Canada does not promote development in their country, just as they know that Canada has no interest whatsoever in democracy. And it needs to be understood that all of the material benefits that Canada has extracted from Guatemala for decades, these are only possible because the Canadian government supported the destruction of democracy in 1954. Guatemala had democracy, and the Canadian government helped to delegitimize and destroy it, and they celebrated that destruction. And actually being there, visiting with people who have been impacted, not only by Canadian companies, but the overall destruction wrought by the Canadian-backed coup, it hammered home to me again, clearer than ever, the fact that Canada will support the absolute decimation of democratic institutions around the world if it serves the Canadian elite's interests. It happened in Guatemala, and it's happened, as Eve and I outline, in at least 20 other countries since 1953. Canadian support for coups can be active or passive. It can involve Ottawa publicly condemning the democratic government in the context of US pressure against it, you know, clearly signaling Ottawa's support for a coup of some kind. Or it could involve Canadian officials on the ground in the country itself directly undermining democracy there. We give examples of both kinds of coups. In the case of Guatemala, Canadian support was largely hands-off. It involved Ottawa refusing to engage with Arbenz, isolating him diplomatically as the US coup gained steam, while at the same time criticizing his government and ultimately celebrating his overthrow and benefiting from the policies that followed. In our book, we detail passive Canadian support for coups in about 10 countries. So Iran, Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, Brazil twice, Indonesia, Uganda, Paraguay, Peru, again twice, and Greece. Countries where Canada played a more substantial role in coups against elected governments include Congo, Ghana, Chile, Haiti, Palestine, Honduras, Ukraine, Bolivia, and Venezuela. A worrisome finding of ours was that most examples of the more hands-on and aggressive Canadian involvement in coups have occurred since 2004. A clear indication that Canadian attacks on democracy around the world have slowly but steadily intensified in recent decades. For example, the scale of Canadian involvement in the 2004 coup in Haiti and the attempted coup in Venezuela since 2017 is massive. In Haiti, Canada funded anti-government groups, demonized the elected government, and hosted an international gathering at which no Haitians were present to discuss overthrowing the elected president. And in Venezuela, Canadian officials were on the ground in Caracas organizing the opposition. Ottawa imposed sanctions against Venezuela, took the Venezuelan government to the International Criminal Court, provided financing to the opposition, and declared that Juan Guaido, this marginal right-wing politician, was actually Venezuela's president. Now, I want to emphasize that this book is not about Canada supporting or propping up anti-democratic governments around the world. That would be a fascinating book, but it's not this book. This book is about Canada's role in overthrowing democracy. And this is a central aspect of how Canadian foreign policy functions, and it needs to be highlighted and understood by Canadians, I think, especially today, as Trudeau and his people participate in these so-called summits for democracy, as they talk about foreign interference in Canadian democracy and things like that. And as Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland and Polyev and all of them talk about how the world right now is divided into democracies and authoritarianism. To me, this is a childish view of the world. Like, in reality, it's so hypocritical of the Canadian government to call anybody else anti-democratic, and I hope that our book explains why. We also want the book to show how Canadian companies benefit directly from Ottawa's interventions against democracy around the world. In Guatemala, it's very clear how Canadian capital benefited from Ottawa's support for the coup against Arbenz. It resulted in the conquest of Guatemala by Canadian mining companies. And we see similar dynamics at play in so many of these Canadian-backed coups. For example, Colombia, 1953. In June of that year, General Gustavo Rojas Pinilla seized power in a coup and launched violent attacks on the peasantry, democracy activists, and more broadly, the left in general. He received very positive coverage in the Canadian press during this time, we found, and the Canadian government supported Rojas and pushed for closer ties with his government because he wanted to purchase Canadian-made aircrafts, specifically Canadair F-86 fighter jets. Lester B. Pearson, who was then the external affairs minister, described Colombia under General Rojas as, quote, the best friend that Canada has in South America. And he noted that selling fighter jets to this violent general who had seized power in a coup would open the door for other Canadian businesses to invest in Colombia as well. So we see here this pattern emerging of Canadian support for coups being directly tied to corporate interests. Another example, the Dominican Republic, 1963. The overthrow of the elected left-wing president there, Juan Bosch, had led to instability throughout the country, and eventually the Lyndon Johnson administration invaded the DR with 20,000 troops to ensure that the left would not return to power. And although Bosch's overthrow was a clear violation of democracy and the US invasion an obvious aggression, Canadian officials didn't care. They mostly cared about the safety of Canadian corporate assets in DR, specifically the RBC office in the country and the Falcondo mine. Lester Pearson, who was by now prime minister, supported the US invasion and said that the Americans only went into DR to protect civilians. Paul Martin Sr., who was then external affairs minister, also defended the US invasion, and he said, quote, it is easy to criticize countries which bear the brunt of responsibility when dangerous situations develop. Furthermore, there was this faction in the DR, the constitutionalists, who supported the return of the elected president to power. And they reached out to Ottawa for recognition, echoes of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala here. And again, the Canadian government rejected that recognition on the basis that the forces of democracy were supposedly being controlled by communists. That's what Lester Pearson said. The US invasion eventually placed Joaquin Balaguer in power, a very unsavory figure who would dominate the country for years to come. And Balaguer received instant Canadian recognition. And during his years in power, he promoted Canadian mining in the DR very visibly. And today, Canadian mining assets in that country are worth almost $7 billion. One more example, Indonesia, 1965. Canada supported the extremely brutal Suharto's coup against President Sukarno. Suharto then oversaw the slaughter of at least 500,000 people after seizing power, and Canada backed him completely. The Canadian ambassador to Jakarta described Suharto as a moderate, sensible, and progressive leader, and an external affairs memo from that time read, it is patently in our interests that the new regime be able to consolidate its internal position. While that consolidation resulted in hundreds of thousands of state murders, a nationwide bloodbath like in Guatemala that Canada supported quietly. Most importantly to Ottawa, though, Suharto opened the country to foreign investment, something Sukarno wasn't doing to the same extent. And Canadian companies, including Bata Shoes and the Inco Mining Company, benefited enormously from Suharto's policies, and they didn't pay any mind, it seems, to the slaughter that was necessary to open up these resources to foreign exploitation. Ghana, 1966. Canadian-trained officers overthrow socialist president Kwame Nkrumah, and Canada's High Commissioner in Accra celebrates the coup and Canada's role in it. And in the decades that follow, Canadian mining investment in Ghana skyrockets. Uganda, 1971. President Milton Obote is moving to the left. He's nationalizing some of these big Western-owned assets, including Canadian assets. And as he's doing so, he's losing the support of many Western countries. Shortly thereafter, he's overthrown in a coup by someone you may have heard about, General Idi Amin. Amin returns nationalized assets to Canadian companies, and Canada's CETA liaison in Uganda lavishes praise on him and his new government. She says that Idi Amin's coup, quote, promises to be an improvement on Obote's government. And she adds, the new administration favors democracy and Western civilization, while the former one favored the communists. So the record shows that Canada quietly supported Idi Amin's seizure of power, praising him and sidestepping any opportunity to condemn it. And I don't think I need to elucidate what Amin did while he was in power, but suffice to say, it's hard to reconcile Canadian claims that we promote democracy with Canada's support for Amin's coup. And the list goes on and on. Chile, 1973. Canada opposes the elected socialist president, Salvador Allende, supports General Pinochet's coup and the repression that follows. And Canadian companies, especially mining companies, pour into Chile in the aftermath. And today, Chile holds 16% of Canadian mining assets abroad, a value of $35 billion. Honduras, 2009. Elected President Manuel Zelaya implements numerous policies that piss the Canadians off, including working with Venezuela's Hugo Chavez on regional integration initiatives and placing a moratorium on new mining concessions. Well, when the Honduran military overthrows Zelaya, they lift the mining moratorium and they get Ottawa's vocal backing, even as they engage in widespread violence against democracy activists, social movements, the opposition, and journalists. And in the aftermath of the coup, Honduras actually becomes the most dangerous country in the world for journalists. But Ottawa didn't care. In fact, the Harper government signed a free trade agreement with the post-coup government very quickly. So it's obvious that Canada had no concern whatsoever for the state of Honduran democracy. And I think it's also worth spending some time on Haiti, because the tragedy in Haiti continues to this day, the multi-century tragedy, and Canada is still playing a nefarious role there, disrespecting Haitian sovereignty. This time, like currently in this moment right now, training Kenyan-led invasion forces that are going to be dispatched to Haiti to fight gangs, ostensibly, but really to prop up the deeply unpopular and unelected government in that country. The current president of Haiti is Gary Conille, who was chosen by the so-called Transitional Council, which was set up by the CARICOM organization with the US several months ago after the resignation of Ariel Henry. And as this invasion force readies to go into Haiti, Canada, as I said, has been involved in training them. There were 70 Canadian Armed Forces members sent to Jamaica specifically for that purpose. But what we in Canada often lose sight of is the fact that this terrible situation in Haiti has, as one of its more immediate causes, another Canadian-backed coup, the coup against Jean-Bertrand Aristide in 2004. Aristide was a left-wing leader, a liberation theologian, who was actually overthrown twice in 1991 and then again when he came back in 2004. And as president, Aristide promised to support the poor Haitian majority and fight the external exploitation of his country, which made him by far the most popular politician in Haiti. And it was because of his popular policies that Canada opposed his government and worked with other countries to remove him from the presidency. When Aristide's party, Fanmi Lavalas, won the May 2000 legislative elections, Canada worked to discredit the victory, essentially claiming that Lavalas had stolen the election. Canada funded quote-unquote civil society groups that essentially were all anti-Aristide. And the situation grew increasingly violent, but even so, Aristide remained very popular in these years and into 2003. And that year, 2003, was the year that Aristide called on France to return the $21 billion it had forced out of Haiti in 1825, the indemnity by which France made Haiti compensate them, Haiti's oppressors, for the horrible crime of having fought for their liberation. Aristide was telling the French, it's time to pay this back. This money never should have been taken in the first place. And of course, France refused to pay it back, and together with Canada and the US, they began accelerating the plot to overthrow the elected government of Haiti. That same year, 2003, Canada hosted the so-called Ottawa Initiative on Haiti, at which representatives from Canada, France, and the US, and the OAS decided Haiti's political future without a single Haitian in attendance. And according to a journalist from Quebec, Michel Vestel, representatives from Canada and these other countries openly discussed plans to overthrow Aristide. And, you know, during this period, Aristide is asking for international support for his elected government. He knows that the pressures are building, but that international support doesn't come. What happens instead is Canadian Special Forces secure the airport in Port-au-Prince, U.S. troops kidnap Aristide, and he is flown out of the country against his will to the Central African Republic. And what follows? Aristide's anointed successor was a guy from Florida who had not lived in Haiti for 15 years, and he promptly undid the gains of the Aristide period. And from there, the nightmare went on. The UN Security Council formed MINUSTA, the so-called stabilization mission in Haiti, whose ranks included hundreds of Canadians. They participated in massacres of civilians, sexual assaults on Haitian women. And in 2010, they dumped their raw sewage into Haitian drinking water, causing a massive cholera outbreak in the aftermath of the horrific earthquake that rocked Haiti. And, you know, the government in Haiti then goes through a series of Comprador presidents, René Préval, Michel Martelly, Jovenel Moïse, who was assassinated in 2021, Ariel Henry, and now this transitional council. And at every stage of this history, the Canadian government sided against the Haitian people and against the popular will, and always with the Haitian elite. And we know what these foreign companies, like textile factory owners, apparel companies, mining firms, some of these companies were Canadian, we know what they got out of the overthrow of Aristide. We know the benefits that they've extracted from Haiti since the Canadian-backed coup. And it's, you know, starvation wages for the Haitian people. It's complete openness to foreign exploitation. And just generally a return to an extremely racist, neocolonial, and unequal economic system. Again, it's a pattern we see over and over again with these coups. And lastly, the final coup that I want to examine a bit more in depth here is Venezuela. I want to touch on the crisis that erupted there after the death of Hugo Chavez and Canada's role in undermining the Venezuelan government that succeeded him and attempting to impose a new state that would offer more benefits to Canada and the U.S., as Venezuelan governments did in the years prior to 1999, when Chavez became president. One thing of note is that in post-99 Venezuela, the Venezuelan government forced large multinational companies, including Canadian companies, to become minority partners in their investments with the government. And this led Petro-Canada to leave Venezuela in 2007, and it led to legal battles between the Venezuelan government on the one hand and Canadian mining companies on the other, including Crystal X, Vanessa Ventures, Gold Reserve Inc., and Rusoro Mining. And these policies led Peter Munk, one of Canada's leading capitalists, to compare Hugo Chavez to Hitler in an open letter to the Financial Times. And it should also be said that in 2002, when the Venezuelan opposition actually did overthrow Chavez for about a day before the people returned Chavez to power, the Canadian government didn't say anything about it. And it was a very conspicuous silence, because Canada is very quick to comment on these things when they happen in countries that Canada doesn't like, if there's an overthrow of a leader who serves Canadian interests, for instance. But in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez is overthrown, and Canada says nothing. The U.S. is very supportive of the putschists as they try to undo everything that Chavez did, all of the gains of his first few years. But of course, Chavez is returned to power, and, you know, Canada continues to say nothing.
You are listening to Owen Schalk speaking at the University of Winnipeg on June 20th, 2024, on the topic of Canada's long fight against democracy. The show is on the Global Research News Hour on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Here is more of Mr. Schalk.
Fast forwarding to 2017, there's clashing protests between government supporters in Venezuela and the opposition in the midst of this economic crisis. Canada starts to demonize the Venezuelan government more and more, and they start to take concrete actions to hurt the Maduro government, including imposing sanctions, freezing Venezuelan assets, and severing diplomatic relations. Maduro was labeled a brutal dictator by the Canadians, even though in 2018 he won a higher proportion of the overall vote than Justin Trudeau did 1 year later in Canada's 2019 election. Canada helped form the Lima Group alongside numerous right-wing governments in Latin America to overthrow the Venezuelan government. This was a group that claimed to be supporting democracy in the region, but it included many governments that had very little democratic legitimacy, and had in fact repressed protests in their own country, including Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, Chile, and of course Guatemala. This Lima group was an entirely geopolitical and ideologically driven and undemocratic organization, but Canada helped form it and really took the leading role in it, constantly leveling over-the-top criticism at the government of Venezuela, condemning them at the OAS, trying to take them to the ICC, and constantly trying to whip up support internationally for toppling Maduro. You know, at bilateral meetings with governments far from Venezuela, like Spain and Japan, Canada was constantly bringing up Venezuela, just yammering on about the need to overthrow the Venezuelan government to countries that were on the other side of the world, even. And this wasn't just rhetoric. On top of the sanctions, which killed tens of thousands, on top of the asset freezes and the Lima Group and the funding of opposition organizations, Canadian officials were actually in Venezuela, on the ground, organizing opposition members in their efforts to supplant Maduro. You know, just the most blatant interference possible. We talk about foreign interference in the in this country, and we don't even know what it is. And Eve and I, we cite publications in this chapter, like the Globe and Mail, Ottawa Citizen, where Canadian officials brag that they engage with tens of thousands of Venezuelans in, you know, conversations on human rights, that's how they put it, and that they had worked on the ground in Caracas to unite the Venezuelan opposition around the pretender Juan Guaido. The journalist Mike Blanchfield reported in an article titled "Quiet Canadian Diplomacy Helped Guaido's Anti-Maduro Movement," and this is a quote, "Emboldening Venezuela's opposition has been a labor of months, the Canadian press has learned. Canadian diplomats in Caracas worked to get the country's opposition parties to coalesce behind Guaido. Canada anticipated Guaido's power grab because its diplomats have been keeping in close contact with Guaido and other opposition figures in Venezuela. Today, the situation is more stable. The Venezuelan government weathered the coup attempt, and recently Ottawa has given some indications that they want to restore ties with Maduro. But that won't wipe away this history of Canadian interference, which was very aggressive in this case. And, you know, it shared a lot of similarities with other Canadian coups, the anti-leftism, the support for forces of right-wing reaction, the support for multinational Canadian companies, the demonization of the targeted government, and everything else. So these are a selection of examples from the book, a brief overview of some case studies that we offer in how Canada undermines democracy around the world. There are numerous others we cover in the book, and I'm sure Eve will talk about some of them. I'll just end by saying this. My hope is that our book will contribute to generating an interest in the realities of Canadian foreign policy, not the myths that are so often peddled about our government's supposed values and how those values supposedly drive our actions in the world. The book itself is pretty short, and the chapters are generally more overviews than extended deep dives into these events. But ideally, the book would serve to both educate readers and to pique their interest so they dig deeper into some of these issues themselves, be it the coup in Venezuela or Haiti or Guatemala or anywhere else. So the reader would feel compelled to broaden their understanding of Canadian foreign policy beyond the myths and beyond the propaganda. So thank you, everybody, for your interest in our work. And I hope you'll take it upon yourselves to educate people about Canada's true role in the world, because it often does appear that Canadian foreign policy is only becoming more aggressive, more heartless, and more disdainful of democracy as the years go on. So it's very important that we tell people these facts and give them these concrete examples, because otherwise there's no hope that we can chip away at the Canadian propaganda machine. You know, large systemic changes are not very likely, let's be honest, but when they do happen, they only happen because of small-scale individual and collective action. That's how it starts. And something everybody can do is just talk to people and give them these examples. You can also form groups with like-minded people, connect with groups that already exist. We can act and mobilize. This is within our power. Even if the horizon of a genuinely just an equitable future seems completely unattainable at the moment. The only hope, though, to break through and to come together with others is to organize around a sincere desire to make the world a better place, to build solidarity with each other, and the global South and indigenous peoples and oppressed peoples everywhere to whom this global system and Canada as part of it deny sovereignty and democracy and genuine development to so many people, as our book shows. And I hope that my work and the book that Eve and I wrote can make some small contribution to that struggle. So thank you.
That was Owen Schalk. His co-author was Eve Engler, who has been a guest on my show many times. He's an author, a journalist, and an activist based in Montreal, Quebec. He's arguably the quintessential critic of Canadian foreign policy. Canada's long fight against democracy would be his 13th book. His writings have also appeared in alternative press and in mainstream publications such as The Globe and Mail, Toronto Star, Ottawa Citizen, and Ecologist. He also has a weekly podcast called The Canadian Foreign Policy Hour. Here he is, continuing the conversation on the Global Research News Hour.
So, as Owen laid out, we detail all kinds of coups that Canada supported. As I've been saying, part of the point of this book is to answer the old joke of why has there never been a coup in Ottawa or in Canada? Because there is no Canadian embassy in Ottawa. So that's part of what we're trying to show. And playing off of what Owen's already laid out, a couple points that I think I want to delve into that are I think worthwhile to think about. And the one is that the Canadian officials pursue these policies even when the likely consequence is quite devastating for those who are the victims of the policies in the countries where the coups transpire. And I wanted to just touch on a couple that are really still in the press right now, examples of Canada's hostility towards democracy and it leading to quite devastating social consequences. And you're seeing that play out. Now, Owen mentioned Haiti. Haiti is really the preeminent example of a Canadian-backed coup, where all different facets of the Canadian state, from the military to the RCMP, the Sûreté du Québec, the obviously global affairs, NGOs, Canadian aid, all participated in the devastating 2004 coup in Haiti. And you still see that play out today, where so much of Haiti's descent over the past 20 years is tied to the fact that the core group of foreign ambassadors, US, Canadian number two, French, Brazilian, Spanish, EU representative, OAS representative, they've been basically overseeing Haiti for the last 20 years, and it's led to dissent. And the core group was created officially, formally, out of the 2004 coup, and it's led to the dissent of that country to the point where there is now a new foreign Canadian-backed intervention in the country. Another example of a coup that's had major social consequences that's getting press right now is, of course, the 2014 overthrow of Viktor Yanukovych in Ukraine. And that led to Russia seizing Crimea. It led to a civil war in the east of the country. It led to Canada instigating Operation Unifier, where Canadian special force or Canadian forces trained Ukrainian forces that were fighting other Ukrainians in the east that were backed by Russia. And then, of course, 2 years ago, Russia, so there was basically a low-level proxy war taking place. And then 2 years ago, Russia massively expanded that proxy war with its invasion. Now, the 2014 coup against Yanukovych is a central political moment in this last 8 years, 10 years, should I say, of a dissent in Ukraine. And there's a few points about the coup in 2014 against Yanukovych that I want to highlight. One is that Canada didn't back Yanukovych's ouster because he was corrupt or because he was repressive. He could have been much more corrupt and much more repressive, and the Canadian government would not have worked to overthrow Yanukovych. The other point, and the reason we pushed to oust Yanukovych was because he supported neutrality. He didn't want to join NATO. And just as most Ukrainians at that time, strong majorities polled showed, didn't want to join NATO because they understood that what would happen is exactly what has been happening, which is the country would be teared apart. It would lead to a conflict with Russia. It would just basically be devastating for the country. And that's exactly what's transpired. So we didn't oppose Yanukovych because of his corruption or his repressiveness. The other thing I want to point out with Canada's role in the coup against Yanukovych, some people, including people on the left, who are supporters of the NATO proxy war, they say that we supported the ouster Yanukovych because we supported the popular uprising of the Maidan protests, which began in late 2013. And it's no doubt true that we supported the Maidan protests, but it's absolutely incorrect to say that we just began supporting Yanukovych's ouster when a popular movement arose against him. Canadian officials, hundreds of Canadian officials, oversaw the election in 2010. They gave it a bill of, they said it was a good election. Yanukovych won fair and square. They didn't like Yanukovych at that time. They were hostile to Yanukovych, but they said it was a fair election. Nonetheless, the Canadian government immediately began undermining Yanukovych. And most significant early move was Stephen Harper's trip to the country in 2010. He brought along all kinds of people that were hardline opponents to Yanukovych from the Ukrainian Canadian Congress and other Canadian groups. And he did a series of moves when he was in the country that were basically designed to undermine Yanukovych, to support this sort of Western, geographically speaking, Ukrainian nationalist perspective. In a kind of sign of the people that Harper brought on his trip to Ukraine in 2010, the Royal Military College professor, Lubitsch, published, who went with Harper on the delegation, he published an op-ed in the Kingston Whig Standard afterwards, where he argued that the real Ukrainian nationalist was not the elected president of that country, but was Stephen Harper. So just a sense of kind of how extreme this sort of ideology that Harper was kind of cultivating against Yanukovych. And then throughout 2011, 2012, continued to work to undermine the elected president of the country. And then in 2013, with the Maidan protests, we did very much support those protests. So for instance, Canada's spokesperson, the embassy spokesperson in Kyiv, her on the side, she was a leading Maidan activist. So she was a leading activist pushing to oust Yanukovych, which of course is not a standard relationship between Canadian embassy and local country, that you can work at the Canadian embassy and be the Canadian embassy spokesperson while pushing to oust the elected government. Another example, in early December of 2013, John Baird, then foreign minister, he attended Maidan protests in the Maidan Square in Kyiv. And Paul Grodd, the head of the Ukrainian-Canadian Congress, announced that Canada's foreign minister was there. And the people started chanting, Canada, Canada, Canada. That's an intervention into Ukrainian affairs. It's not a standard diplomatic affair. In the final days, more than a week, at the end of the protests in February of 2014, that culminated Yanukovych's ouster, the Canadian embassy, which was near Maidan Square, was used as a base by opposition groups to Yanukovych, including the far right C-14. And again, that's of course not standard diplomatic affair. So the Canadian government backed helped destabilize Yanukovych, and then supported, obviously supported opposition groups that were leading the Maidan protests, and supported his ouster. Immediately after there was an unconstitutional change of power, the Canadian government sent aid, supported IMF funding. John Baird made a trip to the country. Harper made multiple trips quickly. Very aggressive effort to shore up this unconstitutional transfer of power. And again, I want to repeat that this has had massive, the coup in 2014, Ukraine had massive impact on Ukrainians and more generally substantive geopolitical effect. Another example of Canada's hostility towards democracy that is playing out in the media today, it still is, you know, has major human toll, is Canada's hostility towards Palestinian democracy. In 2006, Hamas won legislative elections. The Canadian government, immediately after Israel, first country to cut off assistance to the Palestinians. When there was a Palestinian Unity government, we worked to undermine the Palestinian Unity government, try to sow division within Palestinian society, Palestinian political factions. That was successful. There was, and basically it led to a sort of low-level civil war among Palestinians. Hamas responded by these attacks by taking control of Gaza. And that is part of the process that led Israel to justify deepening its siege of Gaza, led Israel to justify the mowing of the lawn campaigns, where they, you know, late 2008, killed about 1,400 Palestinians in Gaza. And the hostility towards Palestinian democracy led to or helped enable the further isolation of Gaza from the West Bank, of Hamas, and of course it led a spiral of worsening conditions, siege, military assaults on Gaza, and then of course Hamas's reaction to that. And today, obviously, we're seeing a stunningly horrendous Israeli military assault. Now, the Canadian hostility to Palestinian democracy is but a small piece of Canada's role in enabling Israel's horrors. But in the context of this book, it's, of course, highly relevant. So I wanted to mention those two examples, or I guess three examples with Haiti, of Canadian hostility towards democracy leading to a significant social consequence. And again, Canadian officials, I don't think that they are pursuing these coup policies with the hope that there's going to be some massive social consequence. It's more that they just don't care, and they are willing to accept the likely results of their policies being substantial consequences to those at the receiving end. Now, the book, Owen kind of touched on this. I think the book is about, for me, it's this continuation of this political project of bursting the bubble of this benevolent Canadian foreign policy mythology that remains powerful even among many on the left. Another motivation in doing this book is a question actually that goes back to the 2005 book that Anthony Fenton and I did on Canada's role in the 2004 coup in Haiti. And when we spoke across the country, we did like 25, 30 events on Canada's role in the coup and launching our Canada and Haiti Waging War and the Poor Majority book. And every talk we gave, literally every talk we gave, we thought we answered the why question in our talk. But every single time, someone would ask, why? Why would Canada do this? This sort of small, unimportant country, you know, why would we do this? Support the U.S. coup. And so there's a number of answers to the why element to Haiti, but one important answer in it is that this is not an aberration, right? When the U.S. destabilizes and overthrows social democratic or socialist oriented governments, Canada supports that. That's the history of it. It's happened many, many times. And when we see the U.S. involved in a future coup effort, we should assume that Canada's going to be supporting it, because that's the history. So there's an answer, or there's a historical message that's important there. Another element in discussing the book that I think is relevant is this, the conflicts we are in today with regards to China, Russia, Iran. The politicians and the media, they frame these conflicts as about a battle over authoritarianism. You know, they're the authoritarian bloc and we're the democracy bloc. When you know a little bit about Canada's role in destabilizing, overthrowing elected governments, it makes it a little bit hard to take too seriously the notion that our conflict with China has something to do with democracy. So I think that's an important point that people should look at going forward. Another thing kind of associated with that is this whole foreign interference brouhaha that is, you know, gripped Canadian politics, the media. I'm of the opinion that the foreign interference issue is, first of all, we should take foreign interference seriously. The UN Charter says that, quote, nothing should authorize intervention in matters essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of any state. And self-determination is a core principle of the UN Charter. So we should take the issue of foreign interference seriously. But Canada has absolutely no moral standing to be making a kerfuffle about foreign interference. If you were in Jacmel or Port-au-Prince and you were hearing about the foreign interference scandal in Canada, and you heard that, you know, the big issue that's like confirmed, that seems to be the big proof, is that a liberal backbencher, Han Dong, there was international students, Chinese international students that were bused to his riding association contest. And so you were sitting in, you know, Haitian in Jacmel or Port-au-Prince, hearing this is the big Canadian, you know, foreign interference in Canada kind of the most, you know, in terms of concrete proof, that's the big one they got. You would be laughing. I mean, Jovenel Moïse, the leader that's basically overseen the country the last 3 years, until about a month ago, that oversaw the dissent in the country, he was appointed leader of Haiti by a tweet from the core group, meaning the US and Canada, essentially. Canadian interference in Haitian affairs is of such vast, greater magnitude of even the most outlandish claims coming from people like Sam Cooper, the former Global News China Sinophobic reporter. So this is I think important that we, you know, look at this sort of foreign interference thing a bit of a broader kind of lens, and I think this book helps to do that. So that's important. The why question, to kind of finish off on the bit on the why question, Owen talked about it a bit. My opinion, the simple overarching thesis is that when the US supports destabilizing, overthrowing social democratic or socialist governments, Canada supports that. That's the overarching thesis. Within that, there's obviously important corporate interests. You can look at the coups against Zelaya in Honduras, and Canadian sweatshop mining interests, Haiti 2004, significant sweatshop interests that didn't like Aristide. So there's corporate interests. There's some of the coups that have, in my opinion, basically nothing to do with capitalism. So in the case of Yanukovych, I think it's overwhelmingly about NATO, about weakening Russia and a sort of geopolitical battle with Russia. In the case of some of the Latin American coups, Evo Morales in 2019, Fernando Lugo Zelaya, more recent ones, part of the backdrop was U.S.-Canadian hostility towards Latin American integrationist efforts that sort of threatened North American geopolitical power in the largely Spanish-speaking central south of the hemisphere. Also, I think kind of somewhat similar dynamic with the coups against Petrus Lumumba, where Canada played a significant role in the early 60s, and then the one against Kwame Nkrumah in 66 in Ghana. Canada also played a significant role there. A part of that was about, those were socialist oriented, but it was also about defeating Pan-Africanism. And both those leaders basically wanted, you know, a decolonization that that weakened European, North American dominance over the continent through a sort of Pan-Africanist vision. So those coups are partly about that. And I guess maybe just to end off, this is a book about Canada's role in overthrowing democracy. And the first step, obviously, in countering future coups is having, you know, sort of knowing the pattern, knowing what Canadian officials have done in the past. So as we've put it, this is a we think a handbook for democracy, a tool to help us stop our government from involvement in future coups. I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Today on the Global Research News Hour, we heard presentations by Owen Schalk and Eve Engler on the topic Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, based on the book they published this year. It is published by Baraka Books, Black Rose Books, or Fernwood Publishing. Get more details at the site yvesengler.com and click on the books menu. The event was hosted by Peace Alliance Winnipeg and was supported by CKUW and the University of Winnipeg Student Association. This is the end of the show for this week. The Global Research News Hour is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced by campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Red River Métis and the heart of the Métis homeland. Music was Shifting Sands from Purple Planet Music. A copy is available at purple-planet.com. I'm host and producer Michael Welch. Stay tuned for more great shows throughout the summer.